Hey, what's going on, everyone? And welcome back to The White Flag, a podcast about getting off that endless treadmill of spiritual performance so you can find joy and rest in surrender with Jesus. I'm your host, Jonathan Moynihan, and today we're coming at you with a great interview with a guy that I have been following for a long time named Brady Shearer. He is sort of a guru when it comes to navigating the digital landscape and helping local churches do that well. And I also just think he's a really brilliant entrepreneur. He's an innovator. He's gritty. He's disciplined. He's been a strong leader of his company for a long, long time. And he helped me as I grew as a staff member and contributed as a communications director for our team. But the reason I wanted to talk to him specifically for our conversations on The White Flag is because I see him, and this is sort of a judgment and a projection, I've watched him as he seemed to do a really good job of designing a digital life where social and media and all those things really were tools in his life instead of traps. And I know you've heard me do several episodes about how your phone hurts your faith and how we need to design a digital life, you know, by design, not by default. And the kindness of Brady to let me connect with him, he's a very sought after thinker and communicator. He actually had just done a podcast before he and I spoke when we did the interview, but I just really was excited to break down what are some of the things that he's done as a mature follower of Jesus that enables him to be so engaged digitally and yet not fall into that trap that hinders so many of us from our spiritual walk. So I'm really grateful for Brady to have him on. I'm really excited for you to take a listen to this episode. If it helps you or intrigues you, just want to talk more, reach out to myself at my website, jonathanmoynihan.com, or in the show notes, you will see information so you can follow Brady and reach out to him as well. But as always, please rate the show, review the show, repost the show, do all those things so we can help spread the word so that more people can adopt these practices of ancient surrender with Jesus as we navigate our modern world. So once again, here he is, Brady Shearer. Let's do it. All right. So we're here. Like I said, today I get to interview a guy I've been following for a long, long time. You know, he's gone through many iterations of haircuts, I have to say, all of them handsome, all of them impressive. But here on the podcast today, we have Brady Shearer. He is the founder and head of Pro Church Tools. He has a lovely family. I think it's growing family.
That's true.
All right, there we go. And he is a faithful follower of the Toronto Raptors, much more consistent than Drake, in my opinion. Always been about the Raptors for a long time. So, Brady Shearer, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
That was an excellent intro, Jonathan. I'm glad to be here. I will concede and confess that one of the first things I thought when I saw you on the Zoom was, I was like, dang, that guy's hair is so good. So, for you to return the compliment with unknowingly... I mean,
there you go.
I appreciated it.
Yeah, but so real quick, how do we think the Raptors are doing? Like, where do we stand on how the playoffs are going?
Well, listen, we're recording this, you know. Well, you're gonna know the fate of the Raptors by the time you're listening to this. We're recording this. Game 5 elimination game for the Raptors is tonight.
Oof.
Look,
where is it? It's
in Philadelphia. The Raptors are down 3-1 in the series. They are the underdogs. They are injured. Their all-star Fred VanVleet is out. He has a hip flexor strain. You hate to see it. Here's what I'll say. Scottie Barnes was announced as the rookie of the year weekend. Yep. Pascal Siakam is favored to make an all-NBA team. Perhaps Fred VanVleet will secure an all-defense spot on the second team. The Raptors over-under in Vegas was 35. They won 48 games this year. Nobody expects them to make a championship run. This season has been an absolute delight, and I could not be prouder of my team.
That's awesome.
Irrespective
dude.
Of how it ends.
I love it. I always call Van Vliet like mini Drake, just because he's
they call themselves like identical twins. The resemblance is uncanny.
It's shocking. Did you even think, no one cares about this except us, but did you even think you'd be in the playoffs again after that run and Kawhi left? Like, are you already like super stoked that they're showing this much promise after Kawhi left?
Yeah, because it's not just Kawhi. If you think about the championship team, it's Marc Gasol, it's Serge Ibaka, it's Kyle Lowry.
That's right.
It's Kawhi Leonard, it's Danny Green. Like,
they're all gone.
Virtually the entire championship team, save for Fred, Pascal. OG didn't play in the championship. He had an appendectomy, of course. That's random. Virtually the whole team is gone. The fact that they've rebuilt, They were displaced for 1 year in Tampa. Like, we kicked them out of the country during the pandemic. They were look, this year doesn't count. Yeah, we'll tank. We'll get the number four pick. We'll pick the best rookie in the first year. Boom. And we're back, haters. So it's great.
Love it. I was the communications director at Mosaic for a long, long time. Following you was such a helpful resource. Then we transitioned a new person into that role. I no longer did it. But following you was still never a question because of just the Toronto takes. I mean, just everything about the Raptors was super engaging. You know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Brady, was because you run Pro Church Tools, and a lot of people who maybe aren't in that sphere of Christian church communication, corporate, all that, they may not be familiar with what Pro Church Tools is, what it does, and even like where your heart is as running that company now. It's a large operation. So for those unfamiliar with you and what you do, kind of briefly give us the spark notes of what you're all about and what Pro Church Tools seeks to accomplish.
Sure. So I went to school to be a youth pastor. I have my degree in theology and youth ministry. In third year, realized I didn't have the relational bandwidth to be a good student pastor, too much of an introvert, too much of a cerebral, but I loved working with churches. And just around this time, I was also getting involved in the creative side of church, which I hadn't previously been exposed to growing up as a child and adolescent. And so I was given the role of media director at my church. That was a halftime position. They put a camera in my hand. They said, go for it. And so I started learning all these creative skills on the fly right around 2010. So, you know, Facebook became public for folks in like 2007.
That's right.
And so this is still the early days. I'm making videos, doing web, doing branding, graphic design, social. And as I'm learning these skills, churches are reaching out. I'm looking to the peers around me in my school and I'm like, man, we're all going to be tasked with these things in our own churches once we get official jobs.
Yeah.
And so I start teaching everything that I'm learning because I can forecast and project that this stuff over the next decade and beyond is going to be incredibly important. And I figure if I learn this from scratch, anyone can. Again, informal training for me, just picking it up on the fly. So around that time, we start Pro Church Tools, the blog, the YouTube channel, the podcast, and we just start, and when I say we, at that point, it was just me, publishing YouTube videos, training content, educational blogs. We've been podcasting now for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, like 600 plus episodes.
Crazy.
So if you are into podcasts, you can search my name, Brady Shearer, or Pro Church Tools. Find our show that way.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
That's very kind of you. Yep. And, you know, from the beginning, our heart and mission has been helping churches navigate the biggest communication shift in 500 years. We have incredible challenges that we're facing right now, but we also have incredible, unprecedented opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so we help churches navigate that shift. We moved from agency work as a company to info products. And since then we've evolved and now we are a software company. So we have a software product called Nucleus.
That's right.
You can find it at nucleus.church. We've got 3,000 plus paying churches on there.
Crazy.
And we're a team of about 15 now, engineers, devs, customer support, creatives, designers, product, and everywhere in between. Been at it for about 10 years, but the through line since day one has been helping churches with free educational content. That's how it sounds like you got connected to us and how most got connected to us. And that's what we love to do the most.
And one of the things I've loved about the way you do things is there's a couple church communication accounts that I remember seeing when I first came on staff in 2012. But yours was always it always had this hyper focus on empowering the local church to keep its own culture. Like, you weren't trying to tell people how to do things as much as you're trying to teach them how to think and really empower younger leaders to cast vision upward to a generation that maybe didn't see the value in some of these digital landscapes. And so, you know, with that heart behind it, empowering the local church, I kind of want our conversation to really be about empowering the local believer as they navigate that great communication shift. And obviously that began long before COVID. But one of the things I keep saying on this show is that COVID was an exposer. It was a accelerator of a lot of things in our digital life. And there's a lot of people who are trying to figure out, how do I have a robust faith in the Lord while also having some sort of presence digitally? Because that is where, that's the public square nowadays. So I think one of my first questions for you is, with 2020 being what it was, parents, people navigating, like, I want to minimize screen time. I want to make sure things are going good. And then all of a sudden, COVID happens. The Atlantic puts out an article saying, hey, dear parents, your battle with screen time, you lost. And everything that's happened since then. What are some themes or trends that you uniquely have seen or noticed in your gifting, in your experience? Like, what are just some of those big headlines that pop out to you about the way the digital landscape has changed, either for churches or for individuals coming out of 2020?
I think for most people, screen time went up, mm-hmm. which is can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your own habits. And I think probably the biggest thing societally has been, and this isn't something I really speak about too often. I find I'm generally speaking to church leaders rather yep. than the congregations.
Yeah.
But what we've seen is the distance between the two sides of the spectrum become greater. And this has been demonstrable in repeated studies, repeated evidence-based metrics.
Yeah.
That the difference between you and your neighbor, if you're on different sides of the spectrum, is now greater than it was 3 years ago. And this has been one of what I would say the unfortunate side effects of digital, as we kind of try to figure out what I would call digital hygiene. We don't yet really have accepted standards on that.
Yeah.
One of the side effects has been the fact that our own beliefs have become like cemented and entrenched and in many, many ways mutated in really unhealthy ways, which is creating that gap between the two sides, which makes obviously discourse much more difficult. Yeah. But to speak to that digital hygiene thing, you know, one thing I often try to impress upon church leaders is we're living through the biggest communication shift in 500 years, like I said, and it's still very, very young in its infancy. Yeah. Like I said, Facebook becomes public 2005. Google Maps is, 2007. Google Maps is 2005. Instagram, Dropbox, Uber, Spotify, TikTok, Twitter, Snap, all of these platforms, Slack, Evernote, that are so crucial to our day-to-day lives didn't exist pre-2005. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, the communication shift has been dramatic. It's been colossal. It's also been incredibly fast. Hmm. And the types of change we've seen in the past decade, two decades, generally take place over multiple generations, mm-hmm. not 15 years. And so what that has done is it's completely changed our everyday rhythms of life. And we haven't yet kind of figured out like what is appropriate digital hygiene to use these platforms in ways that are going to be empowering for us and not destructive or corrosive to our own souls. Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm not really too interested in is like the discussion on, as a whole, is digital a good thing or a bad thing?
Okay.
I think you could probably make the case, and it would be convincing, and I would be fine agreeing with you, to say that digital on the whole is a net negative. But I often think about it sometimes in respect to like automobiles. So automobiles come around and they similarly completely change the landscape of what everyday life looks like when automobiles become something that the average family, average household can obtain. I think you could make the argument that automobiles on the whole are a net negative for society, for the earth, for all of us. But there's really no escaping the necessity for automobiles in the world. And perhaps you live in an urban area and you can get around using public transportation, but for the society that we live in, unless they became outlawed because we really needed to make a dramatic shift and policy forced it upon us, and that would be tremendously disruptive on its own, you can't really escape the necessity that automobiles exist. And digital's much in the same way. Maybe ideally it would not exist entirely, but that's just a hypothetical that's not going to be informative for our day-to-day life. And so personally developing digital hygiene is crucial to navigating the world of social, of digital, and making sure it's empowering for you on the whole rather than corrosive.
So when I'd never heard the analogy to mention automobiles. That's really interesting because you're right. When you look at the collective sum of everything that's come from automobiles, looking at it the same way we look at social, you would call it a net negative. That's really interesting. When you talk about digital hygiene, yeah, it sort of began coming out of that polarization that we're actively navigating. But you're even getting to the specific of the individual. Like, how well do they take care of their own digital brand? And it's how, not digital brand, but digital self, and how that has ramifications on their emotional psyche and physical self. So when you say digital hygiene, it's a new phrase I'm not familiar with. I want to make sure I understand. You're talking about the same way that personal hygiene affects your well-being, you're bringing up digital hygiene in the ways it affects your well-being, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So that would be usage. Mm-hmm. It would be consumption. Mm-hmm. It would be who you choose to follow. Mm-hmm. It would be how you cater your own feed. As a very practical example, traditionally on social, and by tradition, I mean, hey, it's been 10 years.
Yeah.
We've kind of just followed our friends, right? And we add our friends and family. And then the algorithm does its thing and our newsfeed becomes what it is. Well, one way to, you know, elevate your usage of social and improve your digital hygiene is to not let the algorithm tell you what you're going to be seeing, but instead tell the algorithm what you want to see. The thing about algorithms is that they are reflective of human nature for the most part. The goal of a social algorithm is to increase the overall session time that you spend on a certain app.
Yeah, they want to keep you there.
Exactly. Because then they can serve you more ads. That's primarily how most of these platforms are monetized.
Yep.
So it's all about session time. So if you understand that an app wants to increase the amount of time that you spend on its platform, we reverse engineer that and think about the different ways that an app could do that. It's going to drift towards the lowest common denominators of humanity.
Which tend to be aggression, anger, division.
Outrage, things that'll make you... And you don't have to be commenting either. Like, you don't need to comment.
Oh, yeah.
You don't need to like. It watches where you hover. So every time you're on a feed and you see that one person that you're friends with and you don't even know why they're on your feed, like, you know them, but you're not like close. And they're always posting stuff that's wild. And you're looking at it because you kind of enjoy a little bit of hate scrolling, right? You're feeding into the algorithm. The algorithm is agnostic for the most part. It will prey on the worst of humanity, not because it wants to do that over the best of humanity, just because the worst of humanity tends to increase session time more than the good. So digital hygiene, we need to be aware of that and intentionally focus on telling the algorithm what to do, because the algorithm doesn't want to serve you things you don't want to see. You know, it's the classic thing of, I go on TikTok and all I see are underaged women dressed, or underaged girls dressed provocatively.
That's
really? How long have you had the app? Oh, like several months. Be like, that might be more about you than the app, my friend.
That's a
you
good
need
point,
to instruct the app and instruct the algorithms on what to do. They will not keep showing things you don't want to see if you continually tell it you don't want that. If you keep seeing things you don't want, that's probably more of a reflection of you, a reflection of me, than it is the algorithm. And so that's one practical digital hygiene step.
Yeah.
Unfollow the person that you recognize you just hate scrolling for. Tell it on TikTok. Hold down and press not interested when you see something that you don't like. And then when you see that same thing that you don't like, don't hover over it and give the algorithm conflicting messages.
So that's brilliant. Really, really, really healthy to not almost like, obviously algorithms can be problematic, but to really help see the algorithm as a mirror, even on the way in which we're functioning and what we're watching, which means if someone complains about echo chambers, the best way for them to combat that is to willingly dive into viewpoints that disagree with them and invite the algorithm to keep those front and center. That's kind of what you're getting at.
Absolutely. So for me, I put in work to find ways to, as much as I can, ensure a diversity of views in my social
feed
ecosystems.
Yeah.
Now, I also have the standard of I want healthy opposing views. Diversity of opinion doesn't mean I want someone who is a bad actor or, as I would see it, a grifter from their particular perspective on my feeds just for the sake of diversity, because that's
diversity. You're not following the QAnon flat earth crowd, is what you're saying?
Right, exactly. That diversity is not the right diversity that I would want.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm a Canadian, so compared to most Americans, speaking generally, I'm going to be more on the left side of the spectrum than the average American. So, curiously, because of what I do, most of my Facebook feed, as an example, is American.
Mm-hmm.
People that know me, that add me, and I go, okay, I have certain thresholds that I have to meet if I'm going to add you, but I'll add you. We confirm as friends. And now your viewpoints are seeping into my Facebook feed. Maybe not what I would find my close friends and family thinking, or at least like my friend group based on where I live regionally. But now a more diverse set of views are making their way into my worldview, which has been really challenging and healthy for me in the first decade of my adult and professional life. I'm 31. You know, because of all the work that I did, you know, I grew up Canadian. I spent a bunch of time in the US, but I'm still a kid. You grow up and you spend a lot of time with Americans. I remember, like, as an example, first time driving with one of my friends who eventually became a business partner. And I was like, wait, so you actually have a gun in your house? And they were like, you don't? And we both spent like 30 minutes, like exasperated, trying to understand the other. Huh. Curiously, same age, born geographically, not that far apart. Like if you think about the world.
Yeah.
And yet completely different experiences.
Okay. So another manifestation of digital hygiene that I think I've stumbled into, we've talked about this on the podcast a little bit, but it's this idea that when we're not intentional with our digital life, that ecosystem you talked about, we will sometimes allow voices into like the intimate spaces of our life that we would never have allowed any other way. So for example, you're in the bathroom or you're in bed, like highly intimate space, and then you're listening to the opinion of someone that you would never actually invite into that physical realm, but you are digitally. So can you speak a little bit about what you've done, or what even, you know, your family or the coworkers that you lead? Because I know you have a highly engaged leadership style with your business. You go in for spiritual retreats, you pray for each other, like it's a ministry in and of itself. But can you talk for a bit about how you go about choosing the environments and the voices that you allow in, and how those things overlap sometimes to be healthy?
Yeah, so the first thing is determining which platforms you use maybe personally versus professionally. And this won't be true of everyone, because not everyone would be a content creator to the scope that I am. Mm-hmm. But so I'm on Instagram. I publish quite frequently. I'm very active on Twitter, not publishing, but I use that platform personally that I really enjoy. And then I spend a bunch of time on TikTok, bunch of time on YouTube, publishing and consuming. Facebook, very little of either. But then even Instagram, like I don't consume that much. Like it would be TikTok, Twitter, and YouTube as the three where I consume the most.
Okay.
And I just have like, you'll see, if you can go to like following and followers on my accounts, and you'll see the disparity. Like I follow very few people, and I use my social platforms, those three. I wouldn't say I use either of those three, maybe Twitter a bit, in spiritual ways. Like I don't go on those platforms to engage with spiritual thought is a better way of saying that. YouTube, I follow fitness folks. I follow creatives that are teaching me how to like storytell better. On TikTok, again, it's a lot of fitness. It's a lot of fashion on TikTok. And then Twitter is all sports. So like I use those platforms for like almost recreation, personal interest. When it comes to like challenging my worldview, when it comes to thoughtful cerebral exercises, that's books and podcasts primarily.
That's good.
And so categorizing how you use things can be helpful. Before I did this intentionally and thoughtfully, I basically just did an audit on all of my social platforms and tried to like see it from an outsider's perspective. And basically just take inventory of like, what are each of these platforms giving me? Meaning like, how have I used these platforms to then create this feed for myself? But because again, it's a mirror. And then I had to make choices about who I followed, what I saw, how I curated my feed to map to what I claim my values are. One thing I don't pay too much attention to is overall time on platforms. Okay. I know that's something that a lot of people do, and I'm not recommending you not do that. But for me, I've spent a considerable more time curating what is being shown to me rather than trying to like limit how much time I spend on these platforms. Also, because of the nature of my job, sometimes it can be difficult to siphon off what was recreation and personal, which was versus what was professional. And so personally, I don't put too much stock into the usage overall, but that can be another lever that you play with. Like, okay, I can tell personally, after X amount of minutes, and that's what's great is that these devices, hardware devices, are starting to give us this data. you can start to like look inwardly and ask the hard questions. I'm a huge fan of data. I'm a huge fan of spreadsheets. I'm a complete nerd on all these things.
Empirical,
evidence-based. Yeah. And what's great about these digital platforms is that they will give you all that data, and then you can use that to make evidence-based decisions towards better digital hygiene.
So you began by looking at how you were using the platforms. You then evaluated who you were following, and then it sounds like you made a concerted effort to determine what did you want the win of those platforms to be, and then you curated a feed based on your own behavior, what you look at, what you don't look at. And so you almost, it sounds like, Brady, you've made it so that your digital life and platforms serve you instead of the reverse. Because I think for many people, and myself included, I do a 1 week fast of social every month, just to like recenter things. But it sounds like you've actually mapped out a way to make it so that the social serves you instead of you being a slave to it.
I mean, that's the ideal.
That's
right?
The goal, at least. Yeah.
We should be moving toward. I don't resonate with people that say things like, "Oh, you know what? Social is just such a negative force in my life." Or when people like, well, this doesn't happen as much, but like when people will go on Facebook and be like, "I'm off Facebook for a long time. Like, if you want to reach me, connect elsewhere." Probably with the latter because it just seems a bit performative. But I mean, irrespective of that. The reason I don't feel that way is not to disparage anyone that does feel that way.
Yeah, well, the science, the data also shows like higher rates of anxiety and depression all tied to social
precisely.
Use. Like, that is a very real problem. But
so I like just so much good has come to my life through these social platforms and digital tools as well. Mm-hmm. Like my faith has been shaped so positively because of people that I was exposed to digitally that I never would have connected through otherwise. Wow. My enjoyment of recreation, whether it be sports reporters that I follow on Twitter or like Marvel series reaction podcasts that I listen to.
Nice.
My understanding of the game of basketball that I love and I've been playing since I was a kid has greatly increased for the better because of like some really intelligent voices that I listen to podcasts on. Hmm. Not to mention books that I've listened to through Audible that I wouldn't have otherwise read physically because, you know, that's that demands complete focus. Whereas Audible, you can do something physical while still engaging your mind at the same time. And so I have seen so much of the positive. And I believe that on the negative side of things, I can work to remove that, mitigate that, minimize it. And so, yeah, at least for me, that's the posture I take. And it's always evolving as well. I wouldn't be surprised if 10 years later, you were like, Brady, did you ever like take stock of your social usage? And I wouldn't be surprised if I said, you know what? Yeah, I actually, that was something I even got better at. I didn't think of it then, but since then I've done X, Y, and Z.
It sounds like you've been incredibly intentional though. Like you're not stumbling into this stuff. I mean, obviously you're a calculated man who has a vision, you run after it, you're ambitious, you run a business. But there is my judgment I make about you is there's a maturity behind this that I think most people don't take the time to consider. And that's how they get sucked into the trap that can affect like the neurochemical makeup of our brain, the way the algorithms kind of train us. So you've been at this for a long time. You've actually grown with the algorithms because 10 years ago, some of this stuff was coming online for the first time. But I think for a person listening, I don't want you to hear, my heart would be listen to Brady, get the principle of maturity and intentionality and do that work so that you can end up in a good space. This isn't a blanket statement to say, oh, don't worry about usage. I'm talking to a man who's done a lot of work, who knows the algorithms, who is cognitive of the impact they could have on people, who's trying to leverage it for the kingdom. Because, you know, we got high school kids and college kids who listen too, who if I'm being their spiritual director, I know that sometimes the biggest obstacle to like quiet stillness with Jesus is this thing in the morning, and they don't know how to function first thing in the morning without it. And it seems like for you, this isn't a block to a robust face with Jesus the way it might be for some people. Not saying you're perfect, but it sounds like you've done a lot of work for it.
Well, I mean, I've tried, and let me give a real practical example of this.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because this is ever evolving. It's not like you like train your algorithm and then it's like, hey, we trained it. Like it's a constant ongoing process because you're always giving it new inputs and then it's trying to parse that and it's giving you, it's providing new output, and then you go like, no, and keep training it. So I found like at the end of last year, I was like lacking motivation in my professional world, okay. but it was being spurred on by ideology. It wasn't because I was burnt out. It wasn't because I was like in a season where I needed to rest, let's say. It wasn't because I was bored at work. What I found was because of my political leaning, I was getting a lot of like friends or friends of friends, the way Twitter will do it. This was all happening on Twitter.
Okay.
Where they're like, oh, because you follow X, we're showing you this. I was getting a lot of like anti-hard work tweets is like almost the best way to say it. Like
There's a subreddit now called anti-work.
Okay, so it's probably that. You know, it was a lot of like anti-capitalism stuff.
We should all get a universal basic income, stop working hard.
Sure, like sure. Yeah, exactly, that sort of thing. And what's curious is like policy-wise, the reason it was showing up on my feed was because I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, I love universal healthcare here. I am very comfortable family-wise, like with our business and everything. But yeah, if you want to give, you know, UBI, I was like, sure, I'd vote for that policy. Like that was my, like, that's probably my policy belief. I think it hasn't actually been proposed, so it's not like I've had to think deeply about it. But on the surface level of Twitter, I was like, yeah, that aligns, like it aligns. So it wasn't like something was showing up that I was seeing and being like, I don't want to see this. This wasn't like provocative content on TikTok that I was like, ah, this does not align with my values. It did align with my values.
Yeah.
So then I'm doing one of my audits and I'm noticing like months later, I'm like, I think that these tweets have affected me subconsciously to the point where I'm not as motivated to work. And I was like, they don't go against my values, the tweets, but what they've created does go against my values. So I unfollowed those people. And then just did like a week of like, not interested. It went away completely. And I noticed a demonstrable change. Perhaps because it might be placebo, right? Like I was aware it was affecting me and then assumed it would get better. But whatever it might be, that went away. So that's a practical example of curating the feed to align with my values in a way that was a little pervasive, a little insidious, because the tweets themselves on the surface did align maybe with my values. So.
Yeah, but there's a theme of, you know, observation, self-awareness, introspection. And I find myself doing those similarly for spiritual disciplines of what really helped me connect with Jesus 9 months ago. Maybe it was this certain rhythm or certain routine. I'm a feeler. I like new things. And so I inevitably kind of go through cycles. And if I'm not careful, I'll get stuck in something. And maybe something that once served me to connect with the Lord no longer does so, or I need to be cognitive of some adjustments that have to occur, you know, so I don't grow stale in my intimacy with Jesus. So the principles that I've discussed, you're already doing in the social space or the digital space to help you have a healthy digital hygiene. I'm really enjoying that phrase because I'd never heard that before, the phrase digital hygiene. That's, I think, good language, new language can help create new concepts and new thought patterns. So I'm a big fan of that, man. That's really good. One thing that I'm torn about is acknowledging the need to have a strong digital presence as a church. I'm a minister, public platform with a podcast, preach sermons, all that stuff. And yet at the same time, I personally don't have like this huge interest in digital, having a digital life, but I know it's a necessity, like you're saying. So, you know, push back on me a little bit about those. I mean, there's parts of me where I just want to be like a nihilist and get rid of it all and go be a hermit. I've got pastor friends like in California who have done that. And part of me is like, I would love for what that might do to my soul. I would hate for what it would do for my mission. And the mission supersedes my own preference. So I'm going to lean in and be a part of it. But what would you say to somebody who just wants to like blow it all up and give up and sort of disconnect from that digital space? Would you encourage against that? Would you say maybe that's good for you? How would you respond?
Personal question first. Do you enjoy the podcasting side?
I enjoy the podcasting side big time. Like I'll listen to podcasts. I love long form conversations. YouTube is good. It's mostly just I did TikTok for like 3 weeks when the pandemic hit. And then I found myself coming home and sitting in my garage scrolling for like 20 or 30 minutes because it's so addicting. And it was I have 3 children under the age of 5. So it was just taking away from the precious limited space I had. And I just thought, based on what you're saying, I was not mature enough to really step into that. And so I deleted it and I haven't been on since. And when I think about all you've done, I'm like, oh, I could be on it. I'm just not willing to do that work. Like, I'm not interested in that. So I love the podcast space, love YouTube space. I probably don't listen to as many podcasts as I should since I'm in the world of podcasting, but I'm not against digital. It's mostly just like that Instagram brand, TikTok. Just like, I mean, I cringe when I see like those TikTok preacher guys. I mean, you know what I'm talking about. It's like they have a half eaten bowl of soup and they decide to try to do a 6-second sermon on it. I'm like, man, just go read a book. Just stop.
So
that's about me. It's not about them. That's about me and my judgments. But
I have a series of thoughts here. One, as I expected, you're not against digital. You're just, there are certain verticals within digital that you're not especially interested in.
Yes.
And there are certain platforms that have been used in certain ways that you are really resistant or just kind of have ick at, which
yeah, it's like I had a bad burger.
Yeah. And that's true of virtually everyone. For me, I've had a couple of times where like, there's been a platform where a feature within a platform that I have been resistant toward, mostly because how I've seen it modeled, and then I've seen someone else use it, and I've been like, oh, interesting, I could use it in that way. I'm comfortable with that. That's a model, a framework that aligns with me and what I'm about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one lesson there is it's okay to go deep on the platforms that you resonate with, and not go into the platforms that you don't care about. Like one recommendation I always give to churches is, because the pushback or a concern I'll hear is like, there's just so much, how do I keep up? And I say, look, find a platform where your
just
people are, go deep on one platform. That will always be superior than being like shallow, invested in shallow ways on like four platforms, let's say.
Yeah.
And so like if the Instagram, TikTok world of social, you're like, eh, that's not for me. But the YouTube podcast one, that is for you. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're already doing the right thing in spending time and publishing on those platforms. Another thought that comes to mind is like, there's always going to be a vulnerability in the church space if the person who is in charge of social doesn't have a passion for it. And this is something that is pretty common in the church world. But we probably wouldn't want to send, you know, I have a daughter who's 7, as you alluded to at the beginning of the episode, another on the way. You have 3 under 5.
Congratulations.
I appreciate it. I don't think we'd want to send our kids to kids ministry if we knew that the teachers there didn't like kids.
Yeah,
we'd be like, that's probably not the best setup for our kids ministry. So if you put someone in charge of social who like resents it, who like doesn't care for it, I'm not saying that you can't do that. A lot of times we're working with what we have, but we have to acknowledge that that is a vulnerability and it's not something that we would probably stand for in other ministries. And so, you know, that's another thought that comes to mind. And then lastly is like finding creators that you enjoy following. And how they model. Again, I'll go back to that modeling thing. Like what I love to do is I follow very few quote unquote Christian creators on basically any app.
Yeah.
It's just not how I do my own spiritual practice. If you like following those people, brilliant. I mean, some of them are close friends of mine. So it's not that I don't love what they do. It's just not my style.
Sure.
What I love to do is take what other industries are doing on platforms and basically lift their frameworks and teaching styles and bring them into what I do. So most recently, okay, you can make fun of me for this. Recently, I've been getting into fragrances. I've become like a fragrance collector. I have like 40 fragrances now that I own. I don't know why I love it. I'm really loving it. So apparently fragrance YouTube is a thing because I subscribe now to like 3 of the creators.
That's
and
so
what's
funny.
Curious about fragrance YouTube is they publish every single day. I don't know how you can make 365 videos about fragrances, but they do.
And it's crazy.
What I've learned is they have these like go-to frameworks, these like different styles of videos, and they have enough frameworks, enough archetypes, let's say, that they can crank out a new video every single day. And they're the kinds of content archetypes that I haven't really seen elsewhere. And so I've begun like lifting them and basically taking my own type of training and putting them into those archetypes. Not because any Christian creator has ever done it, but because fragrance creators have done it. I've done the same thing with fitness, fashion, creativity, like video or photographers, like whatever it might be. And so sometimes, like, if you're trying to think of how you want to engage with a certain platform, you don't want to engage with it the way your peers have. Great. Don't engage with it or consider engaging with it. If you truly feel like I need to be doing this, but I just hate it so much, like, consider how other industries are engaging those platforms, and then maybe bring that model and then intersect it with your industry, your space, your calling. Now you've got something new that no one else is doing, which is probably going to be more well-received anyway.
Yeah. That's good. That's helpful. Because I go back and forth of sort of paradoxically living in the valuing of digital content and having to have a digital presence, but then like that, the monastic pull of just, I want to go live in the woods and be quiet for 40 years like Thomas Merton and then write books and not do anything. But I know that for the sake of mission, especially in our context, like that's not an option. So I want to do it healthily. So that's good. And it makes me want to go curate a feed that fuels what I want to be about instead of just being reactive to some of this stuff. Because I used to follow, like, you know, close to 1,000 people, and I cut it down to about 90. And I saw a dramatic increase in my enjoyment of Instagram. And I've slowly gotten up to about 110. But it's still like, I have to be rude. I don't mean to be rude, but when someone's like follows you and they say, hey, follow me back, I'm like, I probably won't. Like, I know what I want to be about. And I think sometimes social media creates like the facade of connection, because I saw you did something with your dog, but I would never know that otherwise. So that actually makes me feel like we're close, but we're not. And as a pastor, like, I don't want to live off that. Like, I want to know how my people are doing, but I don't want to live off that. So what are some, one of my convictions for the show is trying to help people slow down. I do think the modern young professional is sort of conformed culturally to operate at a pace and a volume that makes it nearly impossible to connect with Jesus in like still small voice. And the people who I see really navigating our cultural moment well are people who have learned how to set up some sort of guardrail so that they have rhythms of slowing down, connecting with Jesus, being centered on his word, and still having the trappings of modernity. But there's a space where that modern pull doesn't actually like dilute the quality of time with God. So if you're willing, Brady, I'd love to hear. I know you run a Christian organization. You have a shepherding voice in the life of your staff. You pray over them. You talk to them about building a vision for their life. I know you're very passionate about rhythms and lifting. You had your chalkboard wall for a while. I don't know if you still have it.
Oh, yeah.
But what do you do to guard yourself against that cultural pull to operate at a pace and a volume that makes it difficult to hear from God? Like, what are some things that personally work for Brady so that the main thing stays the main thing instead of somebody else dictating what your priorities should be, which is essentially what digital does a lot of the times?
So we're all very familiar with the 80-20 rule, or most likely.
Well, and I would love for you to elaborate it briefly, because there may be people who don't.
Sure. So the 80-20 rule, the idea... No, wait. You know what? Strike that. That rule has nothing to do with what I'm about to say. So that was a misnomer. The 80-20 rule means the 20% of the effort can create 80% of the results. This is actually not that.
Okay.
When I was very young... I'm still very young. I'm 31. When I was 18, 20... 22, I started realizing that, like, the rhythms of life, if we let the world kind of just take us in the direction that everyone goes, we're going to be incredibly destructive for my family. Mm-hmm. And I am not prescribing this for everyone. I'm only going to say what I've done and what we've done with my company, just so that's super clear, because we have been very privileged and fortunate with how the first decade of our adult lives have gone. And again, that's not going to be realistic for everyone. But the lesson here, I still think, is universally applicable. And so when we first started Pro Church Tools, my wife was working two jobs to basically allow us to eat food. So she'd work at insurance during the day and she'd do retail at night. I was full-time in school, half-time at my church as the media director, freelancing with bigger projects when I could, and then trying to build Pro Church Tools. So I'd wake up at 5 a.m., work until 8 a.m. on Pro Church Tools. I'd then go off to school, drop Brittany off at the insurance company, and then I'd do my whole school day and then go to work at the church and, you know, full days. And we were, this is what, you know, often the 20s are about, right? We're 21, we're newly married, we don't have kids yet. We have two cats and we neglected them sometimes, but they were okay. They had each other. And we're just trying to build the life that we want. But I can see, like, the life of my wife being, like, sucked away from her at this insurance job. Hmm. And she's just sitting next to a bunch of, you know, 30, 40, 50-year-olds that are not happy with their own lives.
Yeah.
And so it's negativity, it's gossip, it's slander. It's just, like, the things, kind of the cheap thrills that you rely on when you are fundamentally an unhappy person. And, you know, my heart went out to them. But more importantly, I was seeing how it was affecting... Yeah. You know, the love of my life. And I was like, oh my gosh, like it's been 3 years, forecast like 20 more, and we're like in serious trouble. And that was kind of the impetus for me exploring the world of online business at the time, because what I wanted most was freedom of time. I figured if I could just replace my meager church income, which was like $1,200 a month at the time, I was like, then I can start working on Brittany's income, and we don't have to live extravagant lives, but I want control over our time. I don't want someone saying, you have to be here at this time and leave at this time, and the hours in between, you're going to hate them. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's just, that can't be it. That can't be what we're going towards. And so Pro Church Tools was built off of that ideal. And like so many years later, I think we've achieved that, and we've allowed that to be possible for our employees as well. What I'm trying to get at is that there are certain like hacks you can make on the margins, certain changes that you can make on the margins. But if structurally your life is architected in such a way, it's going to be very difficult for you to like truly embrace that slow way of living, because our entire culture and society is structurally made in a way that's antithetical to that.
Yep.
So for our company, we've tried to bake this into the DNA. And I actually was just revisiting our company's values this morning, and we're having a big meeting on Wednesday. And I want to read you one of the values that I articulated. And there's five values that we have at our company. This is the second one. The value is just vibes, all caps. Now vibes. Let me read the description, which will provide more context. Okay, value number two, vibes. Productivity is not the highest goal. The bottom line is not the ultimate motivator. For what will it profit us to gain the whole world yet forfeit our souls? Practically, this could mean choosing a hybrid work week over peak efficiency, or investing in memorable shared experiences instead of stashing a bit more away. Structurally, we will not sacrifice our collective well-being on the altar of private enterprise. So what we've tried to do is code this ideal into the DNA of the business, so that it's not just true for me, the founder, but it's also true for our employees. And so we do have a hybrid work week. People work at home Monday and Friday. We're in the office Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And, you know, we've always strived to, you know, compensate people well so that they can buy a home, so that they can have a partner stay at home if they choose, so that they can, you know, pay all their bills and hopefully save for the future. And we're not just like scraping to get by. And so it's all about like some things I ask myself sometimes. People say, what do you do with burnout? And I ask myself, is this a feature or is it a bug?
Yep.
Is this a season of life, like a temporary thing that we're going to get through? That's the bug.
Yep.
Is it a feature? And that speaks to the structural side of things. If your life is structurally made in such a way that will not allow you, you can try everything, but willpower, I just don't believe, is going to get you through that. You need to make fundamental changes to the structure, because it's not a bug. It's a feature of your everyday life.
You could do everything right with your phone, but if you're still going to bed at 1 and then trying to wake up at 5, you're not going to wake up with a passion for being able to be awake through a prayer time with the Lord. Like, you're talking about those bigger picture things about what you say yes to the other, you know, 23 and a half hours of your day. And those are the larger decisions. So I really like that, because you didn't even talk about like, oh, I do this one thing with a phone, or I do these couple things. It's more so about those bigger things that we often don't want to face. There's a, you know, we are, I think, I forget who said it, but your systems are perfectly wired to get you the results you're getting. I think Kerry Newhoff stole it from somebody else, but that's essentially true for spiritual disciplines, digital life, everything. So
yeah,
it's really well said.
I mean, in the same way, the algorithm is a mirror of what you tell it. Like, you know, your own results in a lot of things that we do have control over, plenty of life we don't have control over. Like, yeah. Our outputs are also often reflective of our inputs. And, you know, we do have control over those things and taking control of them and, yeah, making hard changes. Again, lucky for me, I made them when I was 21 and they worked out as I intended pretty early on. Change becomes harder the older that you get, I imagine. It seems that way so far. But again, just these are the beliefs that I have. So,
It's really helpful, Brady. Thanks. I have one more question for you if you have time for it.
Yes.
And I think this might be one of the things that you and I would disagree on, but if we were sitting down getting a beer or cocktail, I don't know what your drinks are. I don't want to presume that you drink alcohol, but I always see you with like LaCroix when you do your podcasts.
Yeah, today I have a Diet Dr. Pepper because I'm cutting weight right now, and this is the only sweetness I have. So
there you go. There you go. But coming out of, obviously, all the churches in the country almost and globally saw like this massive uptick in engagement when COVID first hit. Everybody's happy celebrating massive record Easter numbers. And then screen fatigue sets in. Everybody watching just gets burned out by it. People weren't being creative and leveraging the platforms well, and that was part of it. They're just kind of putting a camera on what they already do and not realizing they can do different things because the medium is different. But coming out of it, I definitely find myself having a larger apprehension to like digital church as a valid form of ecclesiology, basically. And I know that there is a value, like we, as our church, we do that. We leverage an online platform. We engage it. We talk to our digital audience. We try to help them engage the best they can. But I'm seeing less and less evidence that makes me believe that it can be a substitute, not a supplement, when it comes to building authentic community. So as you've watched things shift over the last 2 years, maybe you would agree that digital church is a supplement, not a substitute. But I still see people talk about digital church as if, yeah, just stay home. That'll be your thing. You know, what would you say to that? Where are you at with that? Like, how would you advise a church or a person who's navigating that, like, well, you know, my church is, I just watch online right now and that's good. You know, is that good? Is it okay to just like talk to a online pastor in the YouTube comments and that's all you're getting? Like, what's your heart for people as you kind of navigate building robust faith and a robust digital expression?
So if you go to prochurchtools.com, you'll see our big headline. Mm-hmm. The big headline is Seize the 167. And that is a pithy way of saying that there are 167 hours beyond Sunday service. Mm-hmm. If we're going to say Sunday service is 1 hour for the sake of simplicity. How is your church sharing the good news and reaching people in those 167? Because we have such opportunity to do that in ways previous generations never had.
Yep.
That talks about taking advantage of what's outside of Sunday.
Yes.
Since the inception of our company, I have never considered digital to be a substitute. It has always been, in my mind, a supplement. That was true long before the pandemic. It's coded again into our like marketing language that you can find.
Yeah.
Take advantage of what's outside Sunday, but let's not pretend that digital can supplant what Sunday already is. I mean, one of my core beliefs is that, you know, church community is only at its best when it's up close
That's good.
It's experienced in person. You know, when I've gone through a couple tragedies in my 20s, and those were the times when my ecclesiology was cemented because it was put to the test. It was like, do I really have people to walk with through these times?
Or
do I just have people to sit next to and consume worship and a message?
Yeah.
And, you know, the local church and the power of it was proven true in those times because I wasn't alone, and the people that I share a faith with, we really do share this faith together. And so my belief is that digital and in person, or offline and online, are at their best when they are both doing what they can only do and not trying to substitute the other. So I often say, like, online should never replace offline. But I also believe offline can't replace online.
Yeah.
Because you cannot be accessible in person in the same way you can be online.
Yeah.
And, we have heard, like, as one singular example, like countless versions of this, where someone uses social to do ministry instead of promote ministry, and then people are connecting in the comments, and then a person connects with another, and what starts online continues offline that week. And people that weren't connected started like a surface connection online, and then it became more meaningful and tangible and substantive when they got in person. And that's an example of the two working together. They don't need to be combative. They don't need to be like one versus the other. They each have different strengths and weaknesses, and are at their best when we're taking a holistic approach rather than trying to put, you know, square pegs into round holes.
Yeah, and even to your point, there are people, and I want to be clear, in-person church isn't the end result of all your problems, because I know people who go to church, they sit down in the row, they aren't known. And so tragedy strikes, and they still feel completely alone.
Yeah.
And so the damage is you're not leveraging those digital platforms to then engage people, help them know the people that they're walking alongside. That's really well said, man. And yeah, I think that is the tension of, I guess maybe even that, like, the nature of polarization even makes us jump to one extreme or the other when we have multiple options we should be considering. Because that is the case of, you know, when you use social well, you're not only promoting ministry, you're actually creating moments for ministry to occur in the comments and all those things. But yeah, I'm just, you know, I've seen my friends, other parts of the country specifically, who have moved away, have yet to found something great, so they keep tuning in online. Mm. And I'm grateful that they want to engage in the culture and context that we have, but it's not the same. Like, it's just not the same when you don't have people to break bread with, connect with, articulate doubt with. You know, there's a one-way nature to ministry that happens if all you do is digital. So really well said, well articulated, man. Brady, if people want to learn more about you, about Pro Church Tools, or even want to keep hearing from you as an authoritative voice on helping people have a healthy relationship with these ever-changing digital dynamics, where can they follow you? How can they stay connected to you?
Yeah, you can just search my name, Brady Shearer. That's the handle on all platforms, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, and we can connect there. It's always me in the DMs, so if there's specific follow-up and you want to send a DM, Instagram's probably the best place to get a response, but I do get the most there, so if you at me on Twitter or DM me there, or DM me in TikTok, because it's only my wife and I sending each other back and forth TikToks, I'll probably see that one as well, so...
Dude, that's how I hit you up, man. DMs. Like, even like years ago, you were available to me when I had random questions. We were pushing something for Easter, and, you know, I probably wrote you like six paragraphs, and you like gave me a one sentence answer that was super, super helpful. But
at the last podcast I was on, guy from London, pastor from London, he said the same thing. Like, we connected through an Instagram DM, and my business partner first sent me a Twitter DM. He's like, hey man, I like your stuff, here's my portfolio. And I was like, oh my gosh. But I checked it out, because I click on every one, and that eventually...
That's cool.
So DMs, cool. You know, digital can lead again to like real relationship and real connection. So
yeah, I have access to some mentors who I don't think I should ever be allowed like at the table, but it just began with just, you know, people of integrity being available. That's the big part. Like, you operate in a way where you're interruptible, which is what benefits other people and benefits everybody who's listening in today. So, Brady, thanks for your time, man. Seriously. Grateful for you, dude.
Hey, appreciate the invite. This has been a blast.